Dear friends, the subject of our talk, followed by discussion, is, as already announced, on the subject Dharma, the stern law. Let's prepare our minds with a short devotional reading from the Voice of the Silence, appropriate to the subject of our talk. Of teachers there are many. The master soul is one, Alaya, the universal soul. Live in that master as its ray in thee. Live in thy fellows as they live in it. Before thou standest on the threshold of the path, before thou crossest the foremost gate, thou hast to merge the two into the one and sacrifice the personal to self-impersonal and thus destroy the path between the two, Antashkarana. Thou hast to be prepared to answer Dharma, the stern law, whose voice will ask thee at thy initial step, hast thou complied with all the rules, O thou of lofty hopes? Hast thou attuned thy heart and mind to the great mind and heart of all mankind? For as the sacred river's roaring voice, whereby all nature's sounds are echoed back, so must the heart of him who in the stream would enter thrill in response to every sigh and thought of all that lives and breathes. Disciples may be likened to the strings of the soul echoing veena, mankind unto its sounding board, the hand that sweeps it to the tuneful breath of the great world soul, the string that feels to answer in it the master's touch in dulcet harmony with all the others, breaks and is cast away. So the collective minds of Lanu Shavakas, they have to be attuned to the Upadhyaya's mind, one with the oversoul, or break away. Thus do the brothers of the shadow, the murderers of their souls, the dread Dardukpa clan. Hast thou attuned thy being to humanity's great pain, O candidate for light? Thou mayest enter, yet ere thou settest foot upon the dreary path of sorrow, it is well thou should first learn the pitfalls of thy way. We just now heard a couple of verses from the Voice of the Silence. The Voice of the Silence is an English rendering of a very ancient mystic work, the title of which, if rendered in English, would read The Book of the Golden Precepts. What is contained in the Voice of the Silence is a portion of this ancient mystic work. Though Buddhist terms are used in the Voice of the Silence, it is pre-Buddhist, of great antiquity. Anyone who aspires to enter on the path of self-discovery, anyone who has found that no real happiness can ever be found in this life of conditioned existence, in the life of personality, and longs to enter upon the real life. And seeks wisdom and seeks guidance, seeks admission into the mystic brotherhood. It is said that this little book is placed in his hands. And it is, as was read out from the book, the candidate for admission to initiation into higher mysteries has to face his own nature, a very complex nature. Human nature is extremely complex. And he has to unriddle this great sphinx, this mysterious depths of his own being. And this he can do only by one means, and that is by a knowledge of the true self. And dharma, spoken of in the Voice of the Silence, is another name for the true self. So without a knowledge and discrimination of this self developed in him, he cannot make any progress at all. Therefore, it is said that at the very beginning of his endeavors, at his initial step, dharma, the stern law, asks him whether he has complied with all the rules. And he is referred to as one of lofty hopes. Lofty hopes because there cannot be any undertaking greater than this, greater than self-discovery, greater than self-realization. The most difficult and arduous task a man can ever undertake is self-discovery. And no one can take upon a higher ideal than this. So he is a man of lofty hopes. And he is asked whether he has complied with all the rules, which means that one who seeks self-knowledge has to fulfill certain conditions. He has to acquire certain qualifications, and he has to comply with certain rules which are inflexible. This is but natural and reasonable. We see this even in ordinary life, in the world. Anyone wishing to acquire any particular skill or proficiency in any art or mastery of any branch of science or any branch of knowledge has to first of all understand the principles underlying the particular calling and know what conditions he has to fulfill in order to acquire them, and willingly subscribe himself to the laws governing the effort to acquire this knowledge or the skill, as the case may be. So if this is so in ordinary life, how much more it is in the case of the higher the endeavor to tread the path of higher life. And it is said that dharma, the stern law, it is stern and exacting because no compromise is possible and nobody can ever hope to make any progress by circumventing the law as people do circumventing human laws. But nature's laws cannot be circumvented. They are stern and exacting, so exacting that teachers have taught by various examples how difficult it is, so that the candidates don't enter with false hope of attaining their goal as soon as they enter. It is said in the Upanishads that the treading of the path of the higher life is as difficult as walking on the razor's edge, the sharp edge of a razor, without hurting oneself. It is said somewhere in the Gospel, ask, you shall have it. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. Somewhat to that effect, not the exact, the same words. Somewhere in the Gospels. But it is not so easy as said. Easily said than done. But the real meaning of it is not understood. But Jesus himself has made it very clear that, as said in the Upanishads, it is a very difficult path, very difficult road even to find, let alone to walk upon. Straight is the gate, says Jesus, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few are they that find it. And this is precisely what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, which we all know. He says that among thousands of mortals, perhaps a few may aspire to enter upon the path of self-knowledge. Among so aspiring and making an effort, relatively few may attain their goal. So difficult it is, the task of self-conquest and self-discovery. So much so that Buddha shows that greater than the conquest of the world is the conquest of self. And he shows in the Dhammapada that a man who conquers in battles 1,000 men 1,000 times, certainly great. But the one who conquers himself is greater than such a man of physical conquests. And he says that conquest of self is extremely difficult. Is far, far superior to conquest of others. Now, conquest of external conquests, really, it is commendable, great. That's why great conquerors like Napoleon, Alexander, they have been conferred the title of the great. Stupendous achievement. And before them, Genghis Khan. Now, what are their conquests now? Today, the great singer saint of Karnataka, Purandara Dasa, who sang devotional songs, imparting invaluable spiritual instruction to common people through his songs, In one of his songs, he says to the effect that rulers and kings arise, they occupy a stretch of land which had been ruled in past ages by other kings, and then issue a royal edict that they are the owners of this land, and build gorgeous palaces, and build around their possessions formidable fortress against trespass, and then before long they expire, breath leaving them, and their body is cast into the grave or on the funeral pyre, as the case may be. And before long, in the time scale of national cycles, all their gorgeous palaces and fortresses and their conquests perish into dust, leaving relics here and there as a mute testimony to the vanity of man, which tell us that, as Purandarasa says, all you carry is the merit and the demerit you have acquired by your karma, which alone follows you, not all this. Therefore, O man, devote yourself to Purandar Vithala, which is a personification of the higher self. Now, the verse that we heard read in the Voice of the Silence, Dharma, the stern law. What is Dharma? It is a very important question that we must dwell upon. Ordinarily understood, Dharma means the rules of religious life. It is a shastras. Every religion has its shastra. Moses said to have delivered his 10 commandments to Jewish people. It is their shastra. And Jesus is said to have delivered his Sermon on the Mount to Christendom. And the followers of the Vedic traditions have their institutions of Manu, the institutes of Manu, as the basis for religious conduct in life and religious life. And the Mohammedans have their sacred scriptures, Quran and the Shariat, which is their shastra. To the superficial thinker, observer, on the one hand, and the orthodox on the other, the shastras or the rules of religious life, the injunctions of various religions to their followers, they're all different. To them is the mutually conflicting. To their perception, they cannot be harmonized. But in case of a liberal-minded cosmopolitan student of wisdom, there is no such difficulty. He sees in all this religious injunctions a common thread of truth. There is a, if you take just ethics into consideration, taught by all the great teachers, it is patently evident that they all have one common universal ethics, which His Holiness the Dalai Lama keeps saying, the secular ethics. They are not monopoly of any religion. They are universal rules of life and conduct. This universal ethical basis, which is eternal, is what is called dharma. Now, for instance, no religion ever teaches violence. Every religion, without exception, teaches non-violence, teaches truthfulness under all circumstances, charity, and forgiveness of mutual offenses. All of them teach sacrifice, kindness, compassion. And no great teacher and reformer ever came to found a religion. It is a mistake to say that Jesus is the founder of Christianity and Muhammad is the founder of Islam. Wrong to say. They all came to teach the same universal ethics to their followers to suit their needs. And different teachers clothed their teachings in different vestures, so to speak, to suit the soul needs of the times, of the peoples for whom they came. And it is very easy to discern the common thread of universal truth in all of them. So this is one way of understanding what dharma is. In fact, it is said that to define dharma, it is very difficult. To explain what it is, somewhere HBB says, I am not able to recollect where exactly, that it takes several sheets of paper to explain what dharma is. And yet, in one place in the Theosophical Glossary, an excellent definition of dharma is there, which is very succinct, and this is the best definition we can consider. And it says, you know where it comes in Theosophical Glossary? Somewhere, probably in Triratna, under Triratna. The meaning of Triratna, they explain the glossary. In that passage, dharma, a definition of dharma occurs. It is said that dharma is not a person. In other words, it is impersonal. And it is not subject to time. It is not confined to space. It is not subject to causation. It is unconditioned. It is underived entity. Mind you, it is an entity. Combining in itself the spiritual and the material principles of the universe. In other words, it is unconditioned, underived entity, jnana, absolute wisdom. Dharma, wisdom cannot be separated. Law, there is no other God. Law is God. God is law. We'll make a fundamental, fatal mistake if he says God's law. A God who makes law. No. All the gods, creative powers, fashioners of the universe, are all subject to law supreme, which is absolute deity, absolute law. And this is dharma. And in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it is beautifully stated as Aksharasya Prashasanam, law of the imperishable or imperishable law, Akshara. And in the voice of the silence, we have said about this, as the shoreless waters of Akshara, the indestructible fount of omniscience. This is dharma. Now, karma and dharma have to be considered together. They cannot be separated. But what is karma? Karma is action and reaction. It is a moral law. So we think and act and produce causes which bring about numerous effects, and no matter when the causes were initiated by us and when we have to reap the effects of those causes, no matter what the gap of time is between the two, we have to meet the effects produced by our own actions. Either through suffering and pain, in case we have produced bad or disharmonious causes, or pleasure and happiness, in case we have initiated and produced good causes. And this has to go on till the harmony between the cause and effect is fully restored and balanced. So this is the law of cause and effect, the law of ethical causation, which is very closely related to dharma. In fact, we can say these two are the two aspects of one and the same reality. And again, to define karma is difficult. As said, you know, it requires, if we put down all that we have understood of karma on paper, we may have to write several pages. And yet in the Kirti Theosophy, we have an excellent definition of karma by Madame Blavatsky. She says, she answers the question, what is karma? She says, to the effect, not the same words, I'm quoting from memory, that in its abstract sense, is unknowable, it cannot be known. But its action can be known and is ascertained and known by thousands of generations of seers and sages through countless ages, and they have ascertained its action to be absolute justice, intelligence, and equity. Not even a deviation of, without even a deviation of one hair's breadth. Absolute justice. That's how it works. So, karma and dharma are related. They cannot be separated. And again, we must watch against falling into the mistaken notion of law being separate from us. That would be, as already said, a fatal error. That's why it says dharma, the stern law. You have to know what it is. And if you make the mistake that it is somewhere outside of you and that you can deviate from it or circumvent it, that's why it is said you have to know it. You have to answer dharma, the stern law. You can't do all that. So it is our very being, the law of our being. And it is a law of all laws. And again, let's recall what is said about this Aksharasya Prashasanam, the law of the immutable, the law of the imperishable, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Again, quoting from memory, not exactly the same words. He said that by the fear of this law, by fear of this imperishable, the sun and the moon perform their respective duties in their respective fixed positions. By the fear of this law, all the heaven and the earth situated in their harmonious order. By the fear of this law, the cycles of time, small and the great, run their appointed course. The rivers flow, some to the west, some to the east. Men praise the gifts. The gods receive the gifts, receive the sacrifices of men. The fathers receive the offerings of men, ordained by this law, it says. And in order to remove this misconception that it is outside of us, it says that it is our very being. In order to make this very clear to us, it says that the imperishable cannot be seen because it is a seer. Imperishable cannot be heard because it is a hearer and the power of hearing. The imperishable cannot be thought of because it is the thinker and the power of thought, the power of the infinite power of the thinker. It cannot be known because it is a knower and infinite power of knowing. In other words, it is our essential, imperishable self. And this is what Krishna says in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Knower, Kshetrajna. Kshetrajna is the ultimate basis of the universe upon which everything is, on which everything hangs like precious gems upon a string somewhere, he says, probably 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And again, the Upanishads say, which Buddha also says and all the great teachers say, that great is the loss if we fail to know it, dharma. And wretched is he who dies without knowing it. Now, what does it imply? It implies two things. First, it is a law of our being, not apart from us. And secondly, that though it is the very essence of our being, we can remain ignorant of it. We may neglect to know it. We may neglect to abide by it and face the consequences. Now, all the beings and all the creatures, the whole universe, obey this law instinctively. Look at the planets, the constellations, the moon. They do their respective, perform their respective functions and move in their orbits without the slightest deviation. And we see in the vegetable and animal world, the creatures following their instinct unerringly. The instinct of the animal is a manifestation of this imperishable law. They are true to law, they are true to their natures. But in case of man, he may or may not be true to himself. Because he is free will. Why? Because he is a manasic being. The mind principle is there in lower kingdoms of nature, but latent. Therefore, they instinctively follow. But in case of man, the crown of evolution, he is a mind being. So, he is self-conscious. So, he can choose. Now, this principle of self-consciousness, manas, where does it come from? It is a portion of the universal mind, rooted in the imperishable, akshara. And in its lower aspect, it is incarnate in the animal body, bridging heaven and earth. This is the condition of man. He is a dual being. On the one side, he is incarnate in the animal body and experiencing the physical life through his sensorium and mind of lower mind. And this lower mind is again a reflection of during this incarnation of the higher mind, which is rooted in Atmabuddhi, divine, divinity. And situated as he is between heaven and earth, he has a mission to perform. And he has come down here for a purpose. But having been overcome by the illusion of the senses, the illusion of matter, he is distracted. He loses touch with his true nature and self. He becomes ignorant of the law of his being, his Swadharma. And if he is fortunate enough, the fortunate ones are not entirely oblivious of it, but aware of it to some extent and try to fulfill their dharma. It's a choice. And many, many remain indifferent. And as Buddha said, as quoted in the Light of Asia, prefer to hug the spokes of agony of the wheel of life and go from life to life in sorrow and suffering. And he may also choose to take to the path of deliberate evil and run the risk of completely extinguish that small dim light that shines in the depth of his consciousness. Now, what is the dharma of man? So far as the lower kingdoms of nature is concerned, they unconsciously follow. But in case of man, he has to know. What is the dharma of man? As already said, man is a self-being, eternal, spiritual. He is not of matter. As said in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is a portion of the imperishable, supreme, who has performed a sacrifice and descended into the world of conditioned existence for a twin purpose. What are the twin purposes for which he has come down in incarnate life, running the risk of losing touch with his true self? Firstly, in order to arrive at complete self-knowledge, in order to become a fully monistic being, full self-consciousness, complete self-consciousness, complete self-conscious realization of the imperishable, by going through incarnated life after life, individually and personally, reaping the consequences of his acts and learning the lessons from these experiences. And through gardening of these experiences, assimilation of these experiences, to accomplish that ultimate task of attaining complete self-consciousness. And the second great purpose for which he has come down is, he is, by the law of brotherhood, obligated, under the law of obligation, under obligation, to help the jivas, the monads, in the lower kingdoms of nature, which are evolving below him, to raise them up to a higher level. to where he stands at the crown of evolution and raise them up to divinity. This is the purpose for which we are here. To fulfill this purpose is our dharma, manava dharma. May majority of people who are embodied spirits overcome by illusion of the senses remain indifferent and life itself teaches us lesson that a lesson in the sense that a pain and sorrow and disappointments in life which relentlessly come constantly teaching us this lesson, and all are learning this lesson. All are learning. Some may remain indifferent now. They too will one day realize, no, this is not my home. My home is elsewhere. The life that is teaching us the lesson is that the needs of our true being can never be met by the things of the material world, things of the personality. That's why we never attain complete happiness on earth. There is always an aching void. The more you have acquisitions and objects of enjoyment, the keener you feel at one time or other the voidness, a deep sense of a disenchantment and discontent deep in your heart. So such are afflicted, which Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, the four kinds of worshippers are there, the afflicted, right? And those who desire possessions, and the searchers for truth, and the jnani. And these afflicted, the desire possessions, what possessions? Not the possessions of the earth. Wisdom, divine virtues, that knowledge and wisdom which enables them to know the truth. And if they persist, they become jnani, the highest worshippers of Krishna. So, to them the question is asked, have you complied with all the rules? Have you attuned your heart and mind to the great mind and heart of all mankind? Another question asked. Now, what does it mean? As already said, all the minds, the mind of mankind, is the same principle of self-consciousness, not different. My mind, your mind is not different. But it has different qualities due to our karma, that's a different thing. The principle is the same. The human mind is the reflex of cosmic mind. So, the collective mind of mankind is a cosmic mind. And heart is the seat of spiritual consciousness. The spiritual consciousness is seated in the heart. And it is seated in the heart of all beings and all men, irrespective of this status, social status, caste or creed or color, sinner or a saint, the spiritual consciousness, divine consciousness is seated in the heart of all beings. That spirit is one. Just like in 1,000 pots with water reflect 1,000 more images of one and the same moon, the divinity shining in the heart of all beings is one and the same universal spirit. As Krishna says, as single sun illuminates the whole world, one spirit illuminates all. So now what prevents us from apprehending this truth and realizing it is egoism. Egoism is egotism. I am-ness, the mine and thine, the sense of separateness. The truth is non-separateness, but due to the illusion of the senses in which we are situated, we see separateness. And this separateness gives selfishness, gives rise to selfishness. And this selfish action is the most prolific parent of a retributive karma. And we bind ourselves hopelessly to conditioned existence and suffer through it. So this egotistic self is a formidable obstacle, and this we have to get rid of, overcome, transcend. How? By, again, we, though we are situated here in the sensorium and matter, still we have not altogether lost our touch with divinity. It is there as divine conscience. And higher reason, through study and reasoning and reflection and unfoldment gradually of intuition, know the true self and the law of overbeing, dharma, and try to live in accordance with it. Shape and form your whole life in accordance with the law of your being. Thus we come into the path, the road that gradually takes us on to the higher life. Now, we have two antagonistic perspectives, two antagonistic views at all times. And we have two impulses at all times, under every circumstance, at every step, every day. One is the impulse of the false self, proceeding from the sense of separateness, under any circumstance, any situation in life. Our first impulse is, you know, our selfish action, or action with a motive of self-interest. That is the first impulse. Now, a wise man, before acting, reflects. He uses higher reason and intuition, which he has developed through study, and his understanding of the true nature of self to be the self of all and universal brotherhood, and makes the choice of acting from the latter basis, and deliberately sacrifices the motive of self-interest. And this is called sacrifice. In every situation, in every circumstance, it is a conscious, deliberate sacrifice of personal to self-impersonal. It is a question of doing it. It is a question of practice. Nobody can do it for us. We have to do it for ourselves. We have to discover it and do it. We are here for the purpose. What are we here for? If we don't make an effort to live in accordance with our swadharma, of what use is all other things that we acquire and progress, whatever progress that we make, that will earn us name and fame and wealth and whatnot. So, never can a student who has touched upon this truth remain indifferent. And a A person of the world who is ignorant, much is forgiven. But once a student comes to know of dharma, the stern law, he cannot choose wrongly and deliberately without grievously hurting himself and hurting others. Because his action has a profound impact for good or evil on others. So he becomes responsible. So, the creed of knowledge brings the student to a life of great responsibility. Responsibility to his higher self, and responsibility to his fellow men, and responsibility to the fellow creatures which depend upon him for their progress. So it is acceptance of responsibility. No other fellow man can ever be considered with contemptible light. No, even our worst of enemies who do us hurt can ever be considered as enemy. All are ourselves. The sinner and the boor and man of the world, whoever, inseparable part of ourselves. So we are not separate from others. The evils of the world actually is our own evil. Human nature is one. So all the defects in human nature is in us, each and one of us. So as the student following the path of Swadharma gets rid of his defects in the light of the Paramitas, so much great benefit he confers upon his fellow men. And every virtue that he acquires and develops and strengthens in him, there is so much beneficial effect is felt by all of mankind, and he becomes a cause of so much progress of humanity. So our enemies will be seen in this light to be our greatest benefactors, because they give us an opportunity of forgiveness and doing good to those who do us harm. It's very easy to say that, but we have to do it, and we have plenty of opportunities left to do it, and our greatest friends are our enemies. Those who praise us, they are not our good friends. They entrap us. You know, with it increases your self-delusion. But those who treat us badly are greatest friends. So we must have compassion for them. We must rejoice. We must work for their welfare, well-being, forgiveness. So no hurt can come to us if we have not set up a cause. So the hurt that comes to us from any person, it is not the person who is hurting us. We are hurting ourselves by our own action at some point of time. The hand that smites is our own. This realization, this is following dharma. And what glorious songs on dharma Purandara Dasa has sung. It is very, it's all good to sing his songs, but then we must put them into practice. That's the thing. So this is karma in accordance with dharma. Karma dharma. This is Swadharma, following the path of Swadharma. Choosing and acting in accordance with our higher nature and higher self and law of our being regarding all of our fellow men and fellow creatures as self. By this we get rid of and overcome and transcend the egoism, which begins to melt away. So, the imperishable Kshetrajna is where the masters are. Masters are not to be sought for in forms, they are our very higher self. So, to the extent that we live the higher self, which the judge says in his letters, to the extent that we carry out the injunctions of the masters, the path they have shown, to that extent that we become representative of the master. This is the only thing that will safeguard, the only safety factor for man. Not insurance, not that bank balance, they are required, but they are not the true security. They are not the true protectors of him. Dharma is his greatest protector. And several students, like-minded, devoted to the same universal truth, devoted to living the higher life, may not know one another, but they are of one heart and one mind, and their collective effort has a great beneficial effect on the whole world, and they become the cause, by their action in accordance with dharma, of progress of the world in its true direction, in the true sense, in the true way. So, this is how we have to assimilate our mind and heart with the great mind and heart of all mankind. And that is the disappearance of egoism, the death of personality, which is death of death itself. Now friends, I think we must leave for some time to take up any questions that you may have.
The duty of us, why we are born here, is to upbring the lower monads, lower jivas, into the higher one. How do we do that? The lower monads.
The question is based on a statement made that we are here for a great purpose, twin purpose, one of which is to raise up the lower kingdoms of nature to higher life, to where we are. How do we do that? That was the burden of the song of today's talk. We do that by abiding by and following Manava Dharma, about which we just now spoke. Consciously, deliberately. And Buddha has very clearly taught that if you neglect to do this, if you neglect to direct the mind to nobler things, loftier things, to higher aspiration, situated, enveloped as it is in karma, will tend to go down. So it is very dangerous for man to neglect his Swadharma.
Dharma,
Dharma means charity also? Yes, it is. Dharma means charity also. And how it is charity is, charity is not merely giving doles. It is not merely giving material gifts or making gifts of money. Krishna says somewhere in the Bhagavad Gita, sacrifice with material things, sacrifice of material things is of a lower kind of sacrifice. Sacrifice of the lower intentions and motive. In the fire of devotion, with a higher motive of altruism, that's a greater sacrifice. So, charity here is charitable attitude, charity of mind, which is seeing oneself in all beings and all beings in oneself. And forgiveness and doing to others, as Jesus says, what we expect others to do to us. Do any of us expect others to do us injustice? Do we expect others to do us injury? Do we not expect others to treat us kindly? If we so desire, then how are we treating others? We must treat others as we would like us to be treated. This is charitable attitude. And in the light of this higher understanding of law of our being, to be charitable especially and in a practical manner who are inimical to us, whom we may have instinctive dislike, which is a karmic inheritance we have brought from the past, which is to be eliminated and destroyed, rooted out from us. That feeling of inimical feeling towards others, antipathetic feeling should be eradicated deliberately by self-effort and cultivate charitable thought and attitude and deliberate doing of good, practical good to those whom it is like. This is a fundamental law of human dharma. Now today you see in society there is so much of animosity, there is so much of hatred, so much of revenge. You know why? Because they have forgotten their dharma. And dharma is come to be associated with ritual. See, this hypocrisy is called dharma today. That is not dharma. Dharma is swadharma, which Krishna teaches is purification of body, mind, heart. Trikarana shuddhi. To be attempted with knowledge of the higher self and universal brotherhood and law of our being. I think friends will stop here, and next Sunday's talk will be on the subject pilgrimage of life. Theme is the same but looked at from different angles.